if you're at night looking at the moon reflected in buckets of water, you can have hundreds of buckets of water and see hundreds of reflections of the moon. It looks as if there are hundreds of separate moons, but actually it's just one moon reflected in all these different buckets. In the same way, there's one consciousness reflected in all our conscious minds. The supernatural is a category that I don't like at all. It's a product of a split in the 17th century in England, or in Europe, when science got the whole of nature treated as dead, mechanical, and inanimate, and religion got God, angels, and human spirits treated as immaterial and outside nature, the supernatural. Now, I think this split's completely misleading, and the first step in rediscovering God is to drop the concept to the supernatural, because the supernatural implies it's somewhere out there, different and separate, whereas I think the divine or the world of the spirit is actually permeates all nature and is part of nature. And that's what people thought in the Middle Ages in Europe, before the 17th century scientific revolution. Basically, Europe was dominated by a kind of Christian animism, which gave rise to the cathedrals. The official doctrine, based on Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, was that nature's alive, animals and plants are living beings with souls. That's why the word animal comes from the Latin word anima, meaning soul. The stars and the planets were living organisms. The earth was a living organism. And this split in the 17th century that gave us mechanistic science and then a supernatural realm of spirit created this division that all of us have been influenced by. This split hasn't occurred in other cultures. I lived in India for 7 years, and I was amazed, really, at the way the idea of the sacred permeates all Indian life for Hindus. And living in that culture for 7 years, I really saw what a difference it makes to think of the divine permeating nature, that it's not separate. The sacred and the natural are one and the same. I think the other great insight that came to me through living in India was that the divine is really about consciousness. God, in all conceptions of God, is conscious, a conscious being. And so it's not a matter of God is out there as an actual object. You know, sometimes atheists like Dawkins say, you know, we looked in the universe and we haven't found God, however far we look. God is not a being among other beings. God is the consciousness that underlies the universe according to these various religious traditions. And these religions start from the direct experience of a connection with the divine. The great rishis of ancient India, the seers, had this experience of connecting with this ultimate consciousness, which they write about in the Upanishads and the other holy books of India. The Buddha became enlightened not by doing a PhD, but by sitting and meditating under trees. Jesus realized his union with God through a mystical experience that happened at the moment of his baptism. And I think that the connection with the divine for all people at all times primarily comes about through direct conscious experience. It used to be thought that mystical experience, that experience of being part of a greater unity or greater consciousness, was confined to a few medieval mystics in the Middle Ages. But in the 1970s, the Oxford biologist Sir Alistair Hardy decided that religious and spiritual experience should be treated like natural history. You should find out who had these experiences, where and when. And he launched an appeal for information collected thousands of stories from people all over Britain. And it turned out that mystical experiences, the sense of connection with nature through or sense of connection with the divine or connection with a greater unity, were much, much more common than he'd thought and than anyone had thought. And the people who wrote in with these experiences very often said, I've never told this to anyone for fear of being thought mad or mentally disturbed. But it now turns out that these are much more common, and I'm quite sure that many people in this tent have had such experiences. Statistically, is bound to be the case. And many people have them in childhood, you know, to do with nature. And then through near-death experiences, lots of people have a mystical experience. They think, and when they die, they often float out of their body, see themselves on a hospital bed or in a site of an accident, and then go through a kind of tunnel into the light and report an experience of extraordinary peace, unity, and joy, meeting beings of light. Then, of course, they have to come back because it's only a near-death experience. And this experience, lasting a few minutes, changes people's lives. Very often people who've had this experience say they no longer fear death. It's no longer a question of believing in a spiritual realm. They know that such a realm exists. And they often become kinder, more altruistic. Their lives are changed. There's been many studies now of near-death experiences and their effects on people. There's also now been many studies of the effects of spiritual and religious practices. And thousands of papers in peer-reviewed journals have shown that people who have spiritual or religious practices, on the whole, are happier, healthier, and live longer than those that don't. In other words, they help with health and well-being. And so there are many spiritual practices which anyone can do, and I'm sure some of you do some of them, and I'm going to talk about a few of them today. Meditation is probably the best-known spiritual practice today, and as you know, or many of you will know, there are two main methods. One, you concentrate on a mantra, a phrase or a word that you repeat over and over again silently, or you focus through mindfulness, the mindfulness method, on your breath or sensations, immediate sensations in the body. And what this does is creates an alternative center of attention from the thoughts that normally preoccupy us. And those thoughts still go on, but you can, by being more detached from them, you can see them pass like clouds in the sky, rather than being completely absorbed in your ruminations, anxieties, and fears. Incidentally, how many people here meditate or have meditated? Gosh, well, that's probably 80%, I should say. And I mean, it's very interesting that meditation has spread as a practice. When I was a child, I'd never heard of it. And now it's extremely widespread. And it's been secularized so that now there are quite a lot of famous atheists meditate. Sam Harris, for example, one of the so-called new atheists in the United States, is now giving online meditation courses. So meditation is now widely accepted as a spiritual practice, but the interpretations differ. For atheists, it's something just happening inside your brain. You're changing the way the brain's working. That makes you feel calmer. It has measurable effects, reduces blood pressure, people sleep better, less anxiety. So they think of it as entirely internal. But the reason people meditated in the first place, in the Christian contemplative tradition, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, and in Islamic mysticism, in Sufism, was not just to feel better in a frazzling modern world, and for just health and well-being. It was because they thought that the ground of consciousness itself that we can experience through meditation in our own lives is none other than the ground of consciousness of the whole universe, that God or ultimate consciousness underlying the whole universe is that consciousness in kind of fractal versions is present in all conscious beings, including us. A familiar Hindu metaphor is that if you're at night looking at the moon reflected in buckets of water, you can have hundreds of buckets of water and see hundreds of reflections of the moon. It looks as if there are hundreds of separate moons, but actually it's just one moon reflected in all these different buckets. In the same way, there's one consciousness reflected in all our conscious minds. And our conscious minds are part of that greater consciousness, by coming to the ground of our consciousness through meditation, through letting go of all those thoughts that normally preoccupy and distract us, then we come to that ground of conscious being itself. And that can sometimes lead to a great unity of sense, a joyous sense of connection with ultimate consciousness, a kind of mystical experience. It doesn't always happen. I meditate every day, and I have done for years, and that doesn't happen to me very often. But the sense of being detached from these thoughts that constantly flow through our minds is something that's very helpful on a regular basis. There are many different kinds of spiritual practice, and some of them aren't even recognized as spiritual practices by most people. I think possibly the most pervasive and least recognized in the modern world is sports. One of the points of meditation and many spiritual practices is coming into the present. If you come into the present, you don't have time to ruminate, worry, or go through resentful thoughts or anxieties. You have to be totally in the present. Now, sports are one of the ways in which, in the modern world, people come completely into the present. I first thought of this when I was talking to a mountaineering friend who had a business in America. And he said when his business was very, at most intense, he couldn't sleep at night. He was thinking the whole time. He tried meditating. It didn't work. But he said then, when he did rock climbing, by the time he was 50 feet up a rock face, he was completely in the present. So I think that's true of many people in sports. If you're in the middle of a football match, playing football, someone's passing the ball, you have to be completely present. You can't be worrying about whether you paid the gas bill or something your girlfriend said that made you upset or something like that. You're completely present. And I think one of the reasons why in the modern world people do dangerous sports like free diving, free base jumping, free high wire walking, which is walking on sort of rope or wire with a 1,000-foot drop below you without any safety harness. One of the reasons people do this is that if you're doing a sport that's so dangerous that one false move and you're dead, you have to be completely concentrated. I had a conversation with the Austrian champion free highline walker who does 1,000-foot walks over 1,000-foot drops. And he said for him, the reason he did it was because it was the most intense experience he knew. He was completely present, and he saw it as the most extreme kind of spiritual experience that he could achieve. And that's why he did it. He did it not just to win medals or to get praised, and he did it against the opposition of his girlfriend, who hated him doing it and wanted him to give it up, because the survival rate for people in these dangerous sports is obviously fairly low. I think that's one of the reasons why people are attracted to the thrill of speed in the modern world. You know, motorbikes, jet planes, racing cars, that if you're in moving downhill skiing, if you're moving very fast, again, you have to be completely concentrated in the present, otherwise you're dead. And so I think that these are all ways in which in a modern secular world, people have found a way of coming into the present without calling it spiritual, without calling it religious, because these are kind of taboo things in a modern secular, rather atheistic culture. But nevertheless, I think that's why they're doing these things. They're doing it for a reason that is much more than just winning prizes and so on. And I think even participating in sports as a spectator, when people are engaged in watching a football match, for example, there's a kind of intensity. The mood of the crowd shifts all the time through this constant attention to the play. And then it's also a collective identity. And spiritual practices are about a sense of connection with something greater than ourselves. And in a team game, you're part of a team. You have to be something more than yourself. And when there's a lot of crowd, you're supporting your own team, then again, you're part of a group much bigger than yourself, giving you that kind of connection, as well as that connection with ultimate consciousness that comes through being in the present. There are many other ways of being present through spiritual practices. One is connecting with nature. And I think for me, this is probably the most important throughout my whole life, starting as a child. I always had a strong sense of connection with animals and plants and with the natural world. And it's one reason I became a biologist. And I think for many people, probably in Britain more than in most places, that the connection with nature is an extremely important part of people's spiritual life, even though they may not talk about it in those terms. And that can come through plants, through animals, through landscapes, through climbing mountains, through swimming. Again, all of these are ways in which we feel more connected, more present, and more connected to something greater than ourselves. Many people in the modern world also achieve spiritual openings through psychedelics. When people take psychedelics, I first took psychedelics around 1970, LSD. And for me, before that, I was a scientist at Cambridge. I'd been educated in the standard scientific worldview. I'd adopted the kind of materialist worldview. I thought religion was nonsense and fairy tales, that science had moved all beyond that, that the world was just made up of inanimate matter. Evolution happened, but it had no purpose or direction. The mind was nothing but the brain. I bought into the complete materialist, atheist worldview. But when I took LSD, I discovered realms of mind and consciousness that were completely alien to anything I'd experienced before, and convinced me that consciousness is far greater than anything I'd thought about or learned about in my lectures in physiology at Cambridge, you know, nerve impulses, the functioning of different parts of the brain. What I was actually experiencing went so far beyond all that. It was clear there were dimensions that I hadn't explored or known about. And for me, that led to an interest in exploring consciousness in other ways. I then took up transcendental meditation and became more and more interested in spiritual practices. One of the things that, in my own particular understanding, is important, at least for me, is my own ideas about morphic resonance. Morphic resonance is a theory about memory in nature, the idea that there's a connection between similar patterns of activity in the past and in the present. There's a kind of resonance across time. I think that the so-called laws of nature are more like habits, that each species has a kind of collective unconscious or collective memory, a bit like what Jung called the collective unconscious, and that through morphic resonance, by ourselves resonating with ourselves in the past, that our own memories depend on morphic resonance. I don't think they're stored inside the brain, which is the standard scientific assumption. Now, this is a hypothesis in science. It's controversial. I'm not giving a seminar on morphic resonance now about evidence, arguments, etc. But the point I'm trying to make is that this has a direct relevance to several spiritual practices. One of them is the use of mantras. Mantras are sacred phrases used in...
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.